Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders focusing on sustainable and impact investment and performance with purpose, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness in the market and highlight best practices in order to help more companies and institutions transition more capital into the industry faster. I'm JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time in doing this, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. Make sure you subscribe to get the notifications from your preferred podcast platform. And do follow us on social media to stay connected. We appreciate your support. It helps keep Impact Leaders going. Enjoy this episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is safe and healthy and that you are managing as well as you can during these challenging times and extended lockdown. So here we are recording a new episode for you. And in today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Troy Mortimer as our guest. Hello, Troy. Welcome.
Hello, JP.
Thank you so much for being with us. It's a real pleasure and honor. And as a way to have a quick introduction for our listeners, we'll share with you to say that Troy is a sustainability and responsible investment professional and expert. He has worked globally across multiple industries, primarily as a management, over the last 20 years with KPMG. Most recently, he led the UK Sustainability and Responsible Investment Practice, which was voted number one in the UK last year, and has spent a considerable time working with asset owners and asset managers to identify better investment practices. Having recently left KPMG, we have the opportunity to hear from him about his extensive knowledge and experience relating to governance and risk, due diligence, engagement, assurance reporting, responsible investment and ESG practices, and sustainability-related conversations with companies and investors. I should add that Troy is a long-time proponent of transparency, responsibility, and accountability in the industry. And I also must say that I have been a supporter of Troy personally and actively promoting some of his great work. And I'm very excited about future projects that we are looking into developing together. So very excited, as you can tell. Troy, anything I should add?
No, that sounds fantastic, JP.
Nice. As it is a tradition, we as the first question asked our guest the key question, which is, what is a sustainable and impact investing for you, Troy?
Thanks, JP. It's a good question. It's such a simple question as well. What I've seen over the years is that these terms, sustainable investing, responsible investing, impact investing, they started off having very distinct meanings, shifting from a very much focused aspect of financial returns, going all the way into the philanthropic side of things. But what we've seen over the last few years is this merging of terms. ESG investing has started to become impact investing. And what we've basically come to define now as impact investing is a kind of investment that's seeking out financial returns, but that is creating some other broader impact. Now, that might, one way of measuring it might not be initially from a financial perspective, but there's some kind of outcome that's also being created with the capital that's being allocated to that particular investment decision. I think a broad point here is if we think about investments historically and what's the focus of companies, we go back to Milton Friedman's kind of maximizing shareholder value. Well, I see this kind of shift and move towards impact investing now as being almost a redefining of what shareholders value. So we're actually not going against the Friedman side, we're just redefining what that value is of those shareholders. And that kind of in a nutshell is what I'm defining as impact investing.
Great. That's a very good point. So shareholder value now means, sustainability in a way.
Absolutely. It's getting a financial return, but not at any cost. People are starting to recognize that it's not just about creating wealth either for yourself or for the next generation, but it's also recognizing the environment in which that future capital will be expended and enjoyed and used. There's increasingly a value that's being associated with one's kind of sacrifice of capital in the short term for a longer term objective. And it's funny, but we're in a very particular situation right now, the whole world with this COVID-19, where we've started to realize that this virus that's impacting us all with dire consequences is also coming back and having some positive benefits, such as cleaner air and community spirits and just a general recognition that we can attain a better work-life balance. There's an opportunity to increase our personal well-being through focusing on physical fitness, etc. And all those kind of intangibles or non-financial returns are sort of a benefit that's coming back, a return, if you will, off of this investment. So we can talk more about that later,
but
that's kind of what I'm talking about, this other aspect of capital that's not just a figure that, you know, sits in a bank account or looked at in your investment statement.
Yes, let's come back to that. And then just for a bit of context, you know, so that people get a better idea of what you have done so far, you know, about kind of your professional career and the work that you have done to date. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Of course. So I started my career, so I'm Canadian by background, but I started my career in Latin America, first in Mexico and then in Panama, initially working with a small Canadian business that was setting up operations in Panama, trying to promote working opportunities between those two countries. That led to working with a couple government bodies and later with a Canadian NGO operating in Latin America that liaised with multilateral development banks and the government to help development and promote kind of training programs down in Latin America. You know, what this did is it exposed me firsthand to this need to transfer skills and knowledge as well as capital to areas of great need. You know, it was interesting that some of the areas that we operated in Panama at that time had, were operating in situations of extreme poverty, you know, where families were basically surviving on less than a dollar a day. Mm-hmm. So this work with this NGO led to an opportunity actually to join KPMG in Panama. And that's when I really expanded my knowledge of what drives business. You know, how is capital actually allocated? And what is that investment decision-making process by banks, insurers, and asset managers? What does that look like? It also importantly exposed me to some of the challenges that government bodies face in deploying capital efficiently and effectively. So part of my career took me to 2005 when I moved to London, transferred over with KPMG, and began what would be basically a 15-year focus on financial services. At that point in these last 15 years, I became more and more aware of how the world's financial markets are operating and that interlinkage between those key stakeholders. I saw, for example, how stakeholders such as regulators, their role increased significantly. We saw it during market downturns, control failures such as Enron and Madoff, and basically how these enhanced government practices started to emerge from reviews such as the Walker Review and the Turner Review, and there's many, many reviews out there. What this really was pointing to is how there was a real lack of trust in financial services, and we all know the Edelman Barometer that gives us that kind of finger on the pulse of how well we're doing and how well we're trusted. So this kind of low time rating of trust really meant that there was a larger focus on due diligence, getting risk frameworks right, understanding how these financial services and regulated companies are operating and ensuring that they're holding sufficient capital so that they don't go bust, or if they do, they do it in an orderly fashion. And this broader growing need to demonstrate that capital can actually also do good in addition to generating an attractive financial return. So these experiences really led me to develop this deep knowledge within responsible investment and ESG. And we saw how over the last, 5 to 10 years, that shift toward factoring in responsible investment practices and focuses on environmental social governance has been so critical. And it's highlighted just general governance practices, strong and robust risk management, capital adequacy, and just broader control environments, how important that those are strong, robust, flexible. And it also, you know, led me to develop kind of knowledge in how to attract institutional capital. Because effectively, yeah, institutional investors were starting to hold even some of those boutique managers up to a new bar. Regulators started to hold businesses up to a new bar. And that bar continues to be raised.
Yes.
So it's interesting. And I'm really excited seeing how the returns, the financial returns in the market are starting to also be correlated with the level of focus and commitment to ESG practices within the business environment.
Fascinating. Thank you so much for that. It's a great journey that you have had. And it's interesting the link, which you know, starts with this South American and view of the world, which most people, at least here in the UK or in Europe, maybe don't do as much with South America, but there are, you know, about 600 million people, or Latin America, I should say, Central America and South America, that, you know, really struggle. And there's a lot of work being, as we speak as well, with the USA and the IBD, the Inter-American Development Bank. And then it's interesting to see the evolution. You have seen, you know, the full change, especially here in the UK. Like you said, just the compliance requirements, but not for the sake of it, but actually for the improvement of the market and to help us maintain the companies so that they don't go bust. And then I had to just stress on this attracting capital new bar that you mentioned, because it is what, you know, everyone that we are talking to as well is very much focused on, because they're getting the pressure now from their investors, right, in terms of what are you doing. So let me ask you quickly then about your clients. So what type of clients have you worked with or come to you?
So over the course of my career, I've really worked across all aspects within investment management and, you know, just broader corporations. Like, I guess for the asset management industry, my clients have included asset owners, asset managers, as well as those investee companies. And what was interesting for me when I took on the sustainability hat, adding it to my responsible investment one, was a realization that these asset owners and asset managers were increasingly being asked to build ESG products, integrate ESG into their investment process, help to define, identify, extract value from these companies. But at the same time, the information that they were receiving from the investee companies wasn't always conducive to them actually incorporating them into their valuation models. At the same time, working with some of the investee companies, you know, they're seeking new ways to attract new capital, make sure investors are seeing the story that they're trying to tell. But yet we're spending so much time building. And, you know, I remember looking at one client's sustainability report that was over 500 pages, thinking that's not an efficient way of getting information back into these key allocators of capital. So I noticed there's this gap in the market to be able to help asset owners and managers streamline their processes, focus on what really matters, and help investee companies provide that information back to those owners so that they can communicate a bit more effectively. And if I can just draw on a point that you mentioned previous to this point, is that whole world of like multilateral development banks and that allocation of capital, it's not that dissimilar in that, you know, 15 years ago when I started out my career or came over here to the UK, I was leaving a world where multilateral development banks were still very much operating with governments and small businesses. There was very little involvement of large blue chip corporations in a lot of these kind of grassroots projects. It's almost like they were speaking two different languages. Yes. But as we've seen over the last decade, there's been a need to understand each other's worlds, communicate in a way that they can realize that there's a real opportunity, a real synergy, sorry to use a consulting word, but it's true, mm-hmm, that real synergy, an opportunity for blue chips to go and support some of these grassroots companies and initiatives, and that they actually are starting to pay dividends back. And as education increases in the investor world, you start to realize that there's a real tangible financial, but also broader benefit in making sure capital gets to those grassroots projects, and then kind of gradually flows back up. So it's been a really exciting journey to date.
I sometimes, you know, refer to the ecosystems and the supply chains of the investments, right? So I don't know if people all the time understand, you know, what I'm trying to say, but you can actually apply it to different parts of the industries. In this case, as you mentioned, from institutional investors into companies, from companies into the places where they have the production of their products. Let's say, just not to mention one, a coffee company, and we have seen that. It's the one that maybe people appreciate a bit more with the fair trade movement, for example, on the coffees, that, you know, they work with the local producers to produce something that it is, that has a rubber stamp of a of an impactful way in terms of, you know, helping the societies locally to then produce products that get all the way to end consumers, but in a sustainable way. I don't know. I thought I just mentioned that because that's one part, one supply chain of bringing products to market and to people while doing good and creating returns. So I don't know if that's what you were referring to.
Absolutely. You know, a key thing here is the fact that education has really helped to make populations and investors more broadly in developed markets a lot more aware of what an emerging market economy looks like and what the people are like, what those supply chains look like and how interconnected they are. And that's been one of the benefits of sustainability and ESG, is really kind of shining a light on how this, there is this trickle down effect, as well as how product goes, you know, from basically the seeds right into the fork, or from, you know, the point in which raw materials are grown and then shaped into a final product, which is then consumed in some other market. It's that light that's being shone on it that has demonstrated, one, the almost magical aspect of how you convert that, but the interconnectedness, the fact that these populations, whilst, you know, it seems like we only shine lights in the news when there's something negative going on in an emerging market, but the reality is there's so many hardworking people that have commercially viable businesses. And, you know, they're trying to create product for the developed world. And so ESG has been a fantastic way of demonstrating, shining that light on that supply chain and to see how it's interlinked, which is a great opportunity for us to now take it to a next stage of accessing or allowing capital to go down into those smaller profitable projects and really take advantage of the economic opportunities that lie at that level.
Interesting. This is taking a slightly different take on what I had thought we were going to talk about. But before I move back, because I want to ask you something about asset managers again, I was just going to say that coincidentally today I share a post on LinkedIn that was just about, you know, again, SoftBank specifically is investing a lot in Latin America. And then I was going to mention that in places, let's say like Paraguay, I think it's something like 85% of the GDP is generated by small businesses. So again, it just goes to show, you know, how much you can actually help a whole country by supporting these different companies and having these mechanisms in place. But if I go back to some of the great experiences you have had with the asset managers, I would just check with you. So what is it that they have been looking for, and has it evolving in the past years? Has it been a big change? Is there anything specifically that they've been coming to ask you to do?
So there's been a few things, you know, as more and more of the asset owners have kind of moved on from this point of, is it within our fiduciary responsibility to be considering environmental social governance factors as material risks to our overall fiduciary duty of generating a financial return? And that answer increasingly becoming yes. One of the things that asset owners have been coming to me is to say, well, okay, what does that actually look like then? How do we go about really embedding ESG into the way in which we as an asset owner are going to allocate capital, which has meant, you know, looking at principles, looking at what we our fundamental beliefs and drivers are, how to work with third-party asset managers or our in-house investment team to gradually increase these environmental social governance factors into our current pipeline investment opportunity analysis and identify those practices. how to go about engaging and executing some of the transactions, particularly if they deal with, you know, unlisted or real assets. And then that big component around the monitoring of portfolios. And this is where you get into not only due diligence services, so responsible investment due diligence services has been a big, big focus for many of my clients, but also, you know, impact measurement frameworks. And how do we report back on the impact that we're having, considering that there's, you know, longer term timescales here than what we previously perhaps had been asking our managers to report against. So that's the asset owner side. I guess if you're an asset manager.
Just before you move there, just very quickly.
Sure.
So in terms of the asset owners, do they particularly, have you seen that they tend to be focusing on one type of asset manager versus another when it comes to sustainability? And in this case, could be something around like active versus passive or other characteristics?
It's, you know, if we look at like pension schemes as one key type of institutional investor, you know, each scheme will be slightly different in terms of where it stands, particularly on the DB side, of course, to its asset liability profile. So, you know, clearly, depending on what its growth requirements are, there might be a more active focus on the growth side of the portfolio and therefore going out to more active managers that are seeking to differentiate themselves and grow beyond the kind of benchmark returns that they're expected to. But even on the passive side, and this was sort of an initial stage for asset owners where they're thinking, well, I'm running a number of like index kind of portfolios, not really much that we can do. And they've slowly realized that actually that's not the case at all, that even though you're a passive investor, you know, these still have a huge amount of voting rights, particularly in the equity space, that are linked to it. And you can work with your asset managers to help ensure that these companies are acting as they should be. So voting and engagement has started to really kind of climb the priority list in the asset owner space to help ensure that we're getting some of that right outcomes and generating returns in the right ways. So I would say that would be a big focus.
Very insightful, very insightful. If we go back to asset managers, sorry, I stopped you before. What were you going to say?
If you're an asset manager, you know, it's a tricky one. I spoke probably about 12 or 15 conferences last year. And one of the questions I'd almost always ask the audience is, how embedded do you think ESG practices are within asset managers? And, you know, 10 being the most embedded and fully embedded, and one being at all, not at all. And consistently the response from the audiences was at best, you know, between a 4 and a 5. And that usually followed asset owner or asset managers actually saying, oh, we've been doing this for 10 and 20 years. Now, there are certain exceptions out there of managers that really have been trying to champion ESG, whether they've called it that or not. But the reality is that it still is very much of a journey, an evolving practice. And therefore, you know, what my focus with asset managers has been primarily around helping them better integrate ESG into their existing investment processes, creating a roadmap and a journey that enables them to provide like a credible message to owners saying, look, this is how far we've come. These are the asset classes that we're operating against. These are the challenge mechanisms that we have and the governance that we have around it, the reporting around it. This is where we are currently, and this is where we want to go. These are the limitations. And an interesting study has been highlighted. I think it came out recently in one of the news feeds today, Moral Money, around an MIT study, which I was reading about, of the correlation between ESG rating agencies and how at best that's about 60%. And when you think about the importance that these ESG rating agencies have on an investment manager's process, that means there's all kinds of different outcomes that you can get, which therefore means that a manager really needs to have a strong process in place. And perhaps most importantly, they need to make sure that as a corporate, they're acting in a way that's similar to how their embedding investment strategies and driving value from ESG in the investment portfolios. I think that's a real acid test if you're an asset owner, is making sure that you're walking the talk at home as well as with the manager or the money of your clients.
Excellent. Excellent. That's very interesting. Again, if I go back to something you mentioned before and the linkage in a way between the two, or asset owners and asset managers, you did mention the emphasis on responsible investment, due diligence, and impact measurement frameworks. So it's a nice way to then link it to the part that we call the section on identifying and measuring impact. So is that how they are using these tools, these methodologies, or how is it all working for them to understand exactly how sustainable and how impactful they are?
It goes back to the definition of what impact is. And it's been refreshing for me to see how many asset managers are starting to move away from this concept of having ESG-related funds and those that aren't ESG-focused, and moving more toward like an integrated approach of actually just assessing investee companies and potential holdings from an environmental social governance perspective. That ability to look across a portfolio and understand what those risks are, but what those opportunities are and where we want to take a particular investment has been really fundamental, because all of those investment decisions need to feed back into how we're measured. And historically, through investment management agreements and other types of contractual arrangements, we typically set out a return profile that's consistent with a benchmark plus an additional percentage, or it might be an absolute return fund. But there's some broader objective that needs to, that the manager is measured against. And one of the things that I'm starting to see some of the more forward-looking European asset managers is to try to embed impact-oriented objectives into IMAs. And that will be a real game changer, because that then will require asset managers to think more broadly about, well, what is the kind of impact that we can measure against in order to fulfill our broader investment objectives and meet our clients' needs. Now, it's not an easy task, but I think there's a real benefit, particularly when we think about what's been a historic downward trend and pressure on fees, as well as, you know, propensity to shift assets if a particular investment underperforms over a relatively short period of time. These broader impact measurements or metrics embedded within IMAs may well help to create a stickiness of assets that retains AUM, because impact takes time to be created, but it may also help to justify management or retention of the fee structure that's in place. Because of course, creating impact and engaging with investee companies does take time and effort. And you're seeing a lot of asset managers recognizing that and starting to build up strong, responsible investment teams, increasing their voting capacity and level of detail with engagement teams and working with third party providers as well.
Great. And in terms of any, I like the word always, golden nuggets, any tips or any particulars that you can share for any manager that's listening in terms of what they could do, what impact measurement frameworks or what tools they could look in to try to accommodate or fulfill most, if not all, of the concepts that you just mentioned?
Sure, of course. So if I'm conducting responsible investment due diligence on a third party manager, there's some of the basics that you would expect a manager to perform. One of those is the actual communication of what they're doing, whether that's set out in a DDQ or in their marketing materials. But that needs to be consistent with the kind of messaging that we receive on site. It needs to be supported by MI, both internal MI and other kinds of reporting, as well as, you know, external client-focused reporting. There also needs to be a recognition that I need to see that the investment teams have bought into this, not just because it's a do-good thing, because it's something that our clients are expecting, but because the investment manager, so the portfolio manager, really sees how ESG can drive value and how they're working with the responsible investment teams. It's very important that the governance also follows that process. And, you know, if need be, a particular ESG issue could potentially veto an investment and cause either a divestment or, you know, a decision to wait and hold off on investing if it doesn't seem right. It's that conviction of how portfolio manager is going to invest a portfolio, and more broadly, how a investment management firm is going to represent itself to its clients, as I mentioned earlier, really needs to be one of having a view on what they feel is commercially attractive and also the right thing. So it could be that an investment manager chooses to invest in the transition of some of the companies and therefore might be going with, you know, investing in some fossil fuel companies or other companies that are kind of quote unquote dirty, but because they recognize that there's a transition value to capture through that and that they've built up an engagement process accordingly to do that. If that's the case and they're making that message clear to their clients, then, you know, that to me is a credible way forward, and you would expect to see that their investment behavior then follows that accordingly. And you would also expect to see increasingly rigorous expectations of those investee companies and being held to account to make sure that that transition does take place and the value is extracted from it. So it goes back to one of the points you said at the outset around transparency, responsibility, and accountability. You know, transparency is so key, and making sure that your clients are clearly aware of how you're operating and why, and the responsibility of that asset manager is so fundamental. And that sometimes might mean that the asset manager might challenge the client where they're perhaps willing to invest in something that the asset manager doesn't feel comfortable about. Mm-hmm. You know, many asset managers are just thinking, look, I just need to capture assets any way I can. But what really is a game changer is when an asset manager might push back in a constructive way on a client saying, here's why we think you would want to avoid this particular type of investment, or why there's a compelling argument to invest in this particular transition or these best-in-class companies because of reason X, Y, Z. But that responsibility and the transparency is really important because it then takes it back to that last point of being held to account, knowing that you've been open and honest and that you recognize your role within this broader kind of fiduciary agency context.
Yes, that was an excellent way to put it, because I thought made it very clear of, you know, so many components that need to be considered for, you know, an organization to be, you know, a responsible investor. So thank you very much for that. And it also, perhaps it's in there, but if some people may not understand, within a firm, within an organization, an investment management firm, there are all these many stakeholders, right? So we have seen ourselves together, at least once, that you may have, you know, your portfolio manager with an agenda. You may have the, if it is a smaller firm, the owner of the firm with one agenda. You have compliance people that are trying to, you know, push the responsible agenda. And unless the legal counsel who is trying to do his job as well. So, and then unless everyone is pulling and pushing in the same way towards the same goal, you can see that through a due diligence, right? So you can effectively see that the firm is not doing this together cohesively, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, if we think about one of the upcoming requirements of a UNPRI signatory, and that could be an asset owner or an asset manager, one of those is to report against TCFD and how, you know, climate change is being factored in. You know, that's a challenging, daunting task, and one that I think even regulators see as being a bit of a progressive approach that's going to be needed, but one that nonetheless needs to happen. You know, the PRA came out with policy statement 1119 that's requiring banks and insurers to disclose their approaches to managing financial risk from climate change. And, you know, the FCA here in the UK has a consultation paper out, this 23, that came out in March, that that's going to require premium listed issuers to report on climate related financial disclosures or to explain why not. And this is just all part of this broader kind of UK green finance strategy. And there's, you know, many other initiatives out there, the FRC's stewardship code that are focusing on reporting against ESG and climate risks. Like all of these components about the impact of some externality on the business are going to need to be understood throughout the organization. So it's that externalities looking inward, as well as the portfolio and understanding what is the impact of that manager or that business to the external world, if you will. So having a company with divisions and a board that understands that interdependency in those two reporting frameworks is really critical. But when you get that right, you show that you're really on top of this. And for most companies, like I said, they're still on that journey, which is okay. The key is to be open and honest about it.
That was really good that you mentioned. And we will add some links to the podcast just in case for people if they didn't catch all the different letters and names of the different organizations. But that was the PRI, the Task Force for Climate Disclosure, the TFCD, the FCA, and the FRC. And then maybe just to try to complete this part of, well, we can go on for a long time on this, I'm sure, but to try to complete a bit of the other angle and how it links all of this to the impact measurement frameworks, any light that you can share with listeners on that?
So with impact frameworks, you know, one of the key decisions that managers need to make is whether they want to take a kind of a bottom-up approach or a top-down approach. And so a bottom-up approach is one in which you're actually looking at some particular themes that you feel are relevant to engage with, and then to look across your portfolio and to understand how can you report against those themes? What are the commonalities around it? You know, like the CO2 emissions are one of those areas, clean water or intensity metrics. Those are other measures. You can look for commonalities around a particular theme and then build that kind of from a bottom-up approach of the investments. And that holds true whether you're looking at real assets and private equity type real estate assets, or whether you're in the listed markets. And that can be challenging at times, but that's one approach. The other is to take more of a top-down approach. And there's various tools out there. You know, the Real Impact Tracker is one of those. And I've seen many out there. Yeah. What I found interesting about this particular Real Impact Tracker approach is that they take more of a holistic view of the manager, and they look at the kind of public advocacy that the manager is, how visible are they around a particular issue, what's their level of engagement with companies, and then what's the overall integration within the ESG approach. And that gives an overall view of that manager on how they're creating impact at a higher kind of top-down level, which could be interesting for a manager if you're seeking to kind of create a point-in-time view of your impact. So I'm not saying one is better than another. What I am saying is that each asset manager needs to figure out what's appropriate for their view of the market, where they want to go, and how they want to kind of position that with their clients.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. And I should disclaim that, you know, Real Impact Tracker, you know, I was talking to you about it at length recently, and Kari Krasiski, and Real Impact Tracker is one of our advisors and partners, and ILM partners. So there is an episode as well with Carrie that people may want to listen to. Great. So I want to take the opportunity maybe to close this part section on impact measurement and perhaps touch on the SDGs. I think you had mentioned to me something about the ISS launching a tool last week. So I'm not sure if you wanted to share something about that. And the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, as people may know.
Sure. So I guess those that might have caught some of my conferences or speaking slots might have observed that I'm a big proponent within this transparency agenda. And how I think the SDGs are a really interesting mechanism if you are an asset owner or an asset manager trying to kind of assess impact at a holistic level across a portfolio of variable asset classes. The SDGs, you know, they provide this great framework for looking at some of the broader goals that we're seeking to achieve over the next, well, you know, 10 years until 2030, but beyond that. And it's a great unifying tool for saying, look, these are common areas where there's real benefit, but there's also huge investable opportunity behind it. And there's many figures out there about the trillions needed each year in order to achieve that. My point with the SDGs, and frankly with any kind of impact, is that there's always going to be positive and negative impacts related to any investment. And where I found the true leaders in impacts methodology reporting have held themselves out is to demonstrate that actually they report both on the positive impacts as well as some of the negative impacts. They report on when those negative impacts, how much of that is manageable and how much isn't manageable. In fact, it's a residual reality that exists. But in the meantime, those companies look at how they go about reducing the negative impacts whilst maximizing on the positive impacts. You know, that it takes it back to that point of transparency. And if I had a call for asset owners, it would be to do your best to try to reward those companies that are making an effort to be transparent. Now, I appreciate that that means kind of potentially airing some of the gremlins in the closet, and there's this confidentiality aspects to it. But the broader reality is that if there's a negative impact being created by one particular company, those peer organizations are probably subject to that same negative impact. So that prisoner's dilemma that companies face about reporting on negative impacts can be mitigated by, you know, a push from investors to just be open and honest about where they want to go. And I noticed like a LinkedIn post last week by ISS that mentioned that they had a tool around the reporting of negative impacts on the SDGs, which I thought was quite interesting and a potentially very honest recognition of the reality that each investment in every company is going to have positive and negative impacts. So I haven't delved into that tool in any detail with ISS, but I think we're taking a step in the right direction. Last point for a second, you know, that will be a challenge to continue to push forward that transparency. But we really need to remember that the negative impacts from one company is going to drive innovation that will lead to growth in another company that's able to find the solution to that particular issue. So we need to help make those links between those businesses, and we'll start to see real benefits from that. Very volatile times right now in the markets around the whole COVID-19 situation. And I think this is a moment, as much as we can, to kind of pause and take reflection, understand that there've been a lot of positive, I guess, observations made about society during this time, whilst, you know, horrible, you know, in terms of the death tolls, there's been a lot of positive points around cleaner air, better cooperation, better focus on well-being. And so one of the challenges will be for us to remember the good things that we've experienced and help to promote investment toward these types of, I guess, investment opportunities, you know, carbon capture and storage, electrical vehicles, other things that are going to help to promote so that we continue to receive the benefit of these things that we've enjoyed. We can't lose face. That will require real strength and determination on all of our sides to make sure that we promote investment in cleaner technologies. And I guess a real key point that Mark Carney said last week in a speech is that, you know, we can't isolate or self-isolate from climate change. So there's learning opportunities in this current situation that we really need to latch onto, because there will be other challenges as we move ahead. And we need to make sure that we've taken those learning points and can adapt them, because the situation will definitely be different.
Usually, if I am interviewing specifically some of the fund managers, you know, I tend to talk about, you know, the scalability and the transition of capital into their funds. And if you allow me for a second to pick up on some of the things you talked about before, what I heard you say is that transparency, reporting, coherence across organizations with a real good bottom-up approach on how they're going to tackle and create strategies and invest in sustainable companies is what's going to help, you know, that in the future we continue to be able to transition more capital into sustainable impact investing, to be able to scale the current funds and the funds to come. Apologies that it's a question and answer at the same time, but I just didn't want you to repeat everything. But I thought, does that sound about right?
Yeah, so one of the thoughts that I had captured prior to this interview is just around this massive opportunity for directing capital as we go beyond kind of COVID-19 version one. And I think the main message I want to make is that there will be other disruptors, whether this comes in some form of mutation on this virus, climate change, and, you know, Mark Carney's comment that I made earlier, or some other shift that causes that disruption. But, you know, being able to build a resilient and robust ESG strategy and portfolio of investments is going to be key. And this portfolio is going to be need to require that it's based on solid trends that have a positive societal impact and that will align to shifts in broader governmental policy and investment trends. A point that I was making in a previous discussion was how the UNPRI published last year some thoughts on what they call the inevitable policy response. And that mentions some of these key levers that are going to be influencing policy. So things like carbon capture and storage technologies, shifts from internal combustion engines to electrical vehicles, shifts in agricultural practices, carbon pricing, et cetera, as well as an increase in renewables is all going to drive investment flows. So, you know, on the renewable infrastructure side, we've seen how the markets have positively responded with those renewable infrastructure assets having less of a fall than some of the other assets we've seen in the market, and how renewable energy is scheduled for growth this year, while some of the other more fossil fuel dependent energy generation is expected to contract. But, you know, equally important, though, is that there's these renewable technologies and other types of smart technologies out there that are bringing new risks with them. So, for example, cyber risks or the potential for ransomware situations that could interrupt the vital communications between these new smart technologies and the grids which they transmit to. And we've seen how there's been, you know, multiple news headlines of cyber security breaches and ransomware situations occurring during this time of heightened use of technology. So I guess my key message here is that, like, savvy investors really need to ensure that, you know, these new innovative investment ideas are being assessed for some of these newer emerging risk factors and that they're being managed accordingly, but don't shy away from making them, because they're absolutely the shift that we need to take. We just need to recognize there's new risks that we're going to be exposed to and that we're going to have to deal with.
And obviously it goes without saying that all of this is going to affect performance in one way or another. So I don't know if you specifically have seen that your clients that have been more responsible in their investment have, you know, experienced better performance or not, but definitely towards the future, if you don't consider all of these, you are deemed to expect or be affected by all of them and therefore have your performance affected, right?
So those truly responsible investors that have implemented an ESG-focused approach to investing will have made those investments based on these longer-term trends that are absolutely continuing to happen. They try to kind of shelter themselves a little bit from this short-term market volatility. And that's a real challenge given the volatility levels that we've experienced. But if fundamentally the shift toward cleaner technologies, smarter ways of working, and better outcomes for the planets are within the investment thesis, then that kind of buy and hold approach is still very much the one that's going to reap the rewards. And those investors that are buying into those strategies will see that this is not about a 1 or 2 year time horizon. We're looking more 5, 10, 15 years. to see the benefits, and we will see them. I think it's becoming increasingly clear as we have stressed society right now with COVID-19 to understand the things that we really do appreciate. So as we get back to more of a steady state, I think we'll start to see a real rebound in some of these newer technologies, greener technologies. And I think that quite the contrary of COVID being the death of a green economy in ESG, it will be that seed that really, and that rain that really helped to flourish the growth of ESG and properly embed it throughout all investment processes.
Yeah, yeah. And the scary but fascinating and positive thing about the timing that you mentioned, 10 to 15 years, is that, you know, as we both know, you know, with our careers, you know, 10, 15 years just go very, very quickly. Although it may sound, you know, today as a long, you know, a long time to go, it's going to come, it's going to pass, you know, extremely, extremely quickly.
Absolutely. And having kids and seeing how they're naturally more aware of these things is, for example, you know, my daughter is 12, has become vegetarian because she recognized just the impacts of that meat has on the planet and how it's healthier. It's, you know, that kind of awareness is slowly being embedded in our other generations. So whilst we're looking ahead to 10, 15 years to get that financial sort of return, it's good to know that that will come alongside of some of these other benefits that are already starting to be ingrained in the belief systems of, you know, our kids' generations and their children eventually.
And since you touch on that more personal point, and as we start kind of to wrap up the episode, I just wanted to talk to you, ask you a couple more things about you, if that's okay. You told us about how your professional career evolved, but is there one event or one person or a book or something that has influenced you in your life that you want to maybe share with the listeners?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, it's difficult to say that a single individual or a single piece of thought leadership has done it. You know, what I would say is, and it is very much a personal point, but, you know, meeting my wife several years ago now, who had this career in sustainability, having studied at Leeds and Oxford, and, you know, she opened my eyes up to new ways of thinking, which enabled me to look at this slightly different perspective and realize that this was absolutely hitting the asset management world, and that, you know, my role within this broader construct was to leverage the skills and knowledge and experience that I had, but to take these sort of sustainable practices and belief points and help to promote them and embed them. You know, it led me actually to recently write an article on LinkedIn called Collectivism and Responsible Investment, Redefining Us Now or Never. And what I wanted to do by making that article was just to, one, say that, look, you know, ESG is really leading the way. Like there's financial returns. If we want to think of it just very black and white, there's a good compelling argument. It's withstood a strong market shock, and it makes good economic sense, but that there's also these other benefits for us all as humans on this planet, as members of society and pastoral carers of this world that we're going to give on to our kids, that has allowed us to kind of take some perspective of what we want to, you know, achieve professionally, but also give back to those that, you know, we care about in this world. And so that led to this introspection on what is our broader purpose as companies, as individuals, and what is this huge opportunity that we have right now to gain back some of the things that I remember just, you know, 6-9 months ago that we're all complaining about, that, oh, we've got no time. It's such a rat race. It's, you know, we're working 12, 15 hour days. And to take a step back and say, you know what, that workout that we wanted to do, that healthier way of eating, that focus on not throwing away so many things, this time of self-isolation has given us, forced us in a certain sense, to take stock of that and in spite of ourselves and that inertia, I think we've started to realize that there's a real positive benefit for us as individuals, as families, as communities, as cities, as nations, and a group of nations to help benefit ourselves within this capital system in which we operate, but to do it in a way that's will allow us to be better custodians of this kind of world that we live in. And ultimately what we're doing is creating this new kind of responsible, sustainable culture. And so all these ideas of better circular economy and new opportunities to invest responsibly and drive better sustainability practices across the planet, I guess just inevitably creating a more consciously capitalistic world is starting to, we've laid the seeds and the foundation. And what that will mean for all of us is that we will get increased well-being. We'll have greater identity and purpose. And, fundamentally, touch wood, we'll all be a bit more humane, sensitive, and supportive of the world around us. And I guess my final thought is one of optimism, because I know that there's ups and downs and trials and tribulations at this time, but we will prevail. Like, I think we will absolutely come out of this stronger. And our biggest challenge is going to be one to make sure that we don't forget the lessons that we've learned. Quite the contrary, we use those to our advancement or to our benefit to advance things even more quickly when things start to kind of ease up.
Amen to that, Troy. Very nice, very nice. Very, very passionate, and a great article indeed as well. I would recommend people to go and read it in detail and take, a few minutes. And I like the idea or the concept, actually, that we're all leaders in a way. So with all that said, what would you say is to be kind of an impact leader as an individual and as you lead organizations, perhaps, into this new life that is coming for us?
For me to be an impact leader, what I would say is educate yourself, be humble, and recognize that, the more you dig in and find out more about what's going on in the environment and in social change and cultural changes, the more you realize how little you know, and that humbleness,
yes,
I think will be a real positive element to help to direct investment strategies that are going to help to benefit, communities, businesses, et cetera, and drive a return. But education is key. Communication with the key stakeholders around is fundamentally important. Time and patience is also critical, but be brave and take that bull by the horns and go out and do it, because ultimately this is a point of action, of communication and cooperation. But if we act humbly but purposefully, we're absolutely going to end up creating a much better world than what we actually started out with, and importantly, stop some of the synergies that have, or the momentum of some of the negative things that we've seen in the past. Like I said, we're at a great point right now, so this is all really within our control.
Wonderful. Thank you again for that. I really like it, and I must say again, it kind of hits home quite personally. I was just telling you before we start the recording that I just did a selection of a kind of a lockdown series of short podcasts and videos that I'm going to share with the listeners. And I think I mentioned each and every word that you just talked about there in the way that I see things, education, humility, communication, patience, which is, I think, one of the greatest characteristics and skills or features that you can develop. So yes, thank you so much for that. And as we come to the end now of the episode, any one last call to action for the listeners, and also how can people get in touch with you, Troy?
I guess first of all, thanks for listening and coming this far. It's time is always at a premium. And so if you've come to this stage in the podcast, first of all, there's, you know, a real sincere thanks for doing so. The second is, you know, take some time to reflect on the things that we've spoken about, but don't forget about it. It's so easy to be overcome by other messages and other things. The key thing is start to take action in your own way. Have those conversations within your respective companies, amongst your colleagues, inquire what's being done, look at what's going on within your own pension and your own investment portfolio. But start to take small, consistent movements and be purposeful with it. But you'll see, there'll be absolutely, you know, you're going to reap all kinds of rewards from doing so. And if you need to get a hold of me, you know, you can contact me at troy.mortimer2@gmail.com or through JP at ILA and Partners. More than happy to continue the conversation.
Fantastic. And I would also recommend people to check, to connect with you on LinkedIn, specifically follow you and read that article that we mentioned before.
Absolutely. Brilliant.
Well, thank you so, so much for your time. Troy, you made the point about time is funny. We have a lot more time than ever before, but everyone seems to be very busy anyway. I really appreciate you sharing your time.
Thank you, JP. I appreciate very much the opportunity to speak. And, you know, thank you very much for having the initiative and taking that action point to actually create these podcasts. I think they're so important to give us a moment to reflect. And you can listen to them while you're doing your exercise or whenever. But the key thing is to be doing it. So thank you very much.
Okay, thank you everyone for listening, and it is bye for now and until our next episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Please remember to check our sponsors' websites for upcoming events as well. Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA Partners and Fast Forward 2030. Please connect with us at ILA and Partners for advice on how to transition into sustainable and impact investing. And go to fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models.